So welcome to the latest episode of Kennedy's Medical Law Matters podcast. I'm Rob Tobin, Head of Medical Law here at Kennedy's, where we act on behalf of the NHS, public sector organisations and private healthcare providers on all aspects of healthcare and medical law. For those new to this Medical Law Matters podcast, we use this as a chance really to chat about a topic, issues in medical law, and hope to generate some interest and some debate amongst listeners. Over previous episodes, which are all available on your usual platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, we've discussed best interests, the law around the medical treatment of children, assisted dying, mental capacity, media scrutiny, futility, and today we're going to be talking about inquests. So specifically, we'll work through a case study to help demystify inquests and hopefully explain what they are, what it's like to attend one, if you have to give evidence at one, remove some of the anxiety that I know a lot of people will feel when they have to be involved in one. We're going to explore the anatomy of an inquest, I suppose, why it's held, who's involved, what organisations, families, witnesses are involved, and what they can all expect throughout the process. So whether you're a healthcare professional, insurer, legal practitioner, or simply someone who's just interested in understanding how the coronial system works, we'll take you through that journey from the initial referral or the initial letter you might get from a coroner to the conclusion of the inquest. I do want to stress at the outset that this podcast episode does contain some discussions around mental health and suicide and other aspects of medical treatment, which some listeners might find distressing. So I'm delighted today to be joined by my colleagues, Dan Freeman and Indy Kaur. Perhaps I'll let you both introduce yourselves. So Dan, trying to go first?
Thanks, Rob. As Rob said, my name is Dan Creedon. I'm a partner at Kennedy's. I've been at Kennedy's for 17 years now, which is quite terrifying. And I specialise in inquests, court protection, best interests, judicial review and medical law.
Thanks, Dan. And Indy.
Hi, thanks, Rob. My name's Indy Kaur and I'm a legal director and I've been at Kennedy's almost 5 years. And similarly to Dan, I also deal with serious medical treatment cases, inquests, best interest decisions and judicial review.
So before we start on the case study, Dan, perhaps you could explain to listeners what an inquest is.
So the purpose of an inquest, Rob, is that it's there to try and establish publicly facts surrounding the death of a person. It's a fact-finding investigation, and it is what it says on the tin, really. It's inquisitorial. It's not there to place blame. It's not a trial, and it's definitely not there to be determining civil or criminal liability. The coroner is there to establish facts and to work out, effectively on the balance of probabilities, certain facts as to what happened. Any facts that come out at an inquest, the coroner has to balance that as to what facts he or she prefers on the balance of probabilities. So if there is a conflict or if there is a query, whether that be over medical records or whether that be over some hearsay evidence or factual evidence, the coroner has to decide on the balance of probabilities which type of facts that she would prefer, he or she would prefer. And when we say balance of probabilities, we mean more than 50%. The other test that the coroner has to take into account when we're looking at how the deceased passed away is whether an act or omission of a person or even the deceased themselves more than minimally contributed to the death. And so those are the tests that the coroner has to look at when they're establishing facts and on their fact-finding exercise.
Thanks, Dan. This is a medical law podcast, and so we're talking about inquests concerning medical cases, so deaths either in hospital or perhaps in care homes or in some way related to medical treatment. We're not talking about other deaths, like, for example, in road traffic accidents, accidents at work, that sort of thing, which, of course, are equally valid for the coroner, but still clear that up. So, Indy, Dan alluded to it. The coroner, at the beginning of every case, will always introduce the matter by saying, I'm here to talk about the death of so-and-so and to establish the answers to four questions. So can you talk us through those four questions, please?
Thanks, Rob. So as Dan has said, because this is an inquisitorial rather than adversarial inquest, the coroner is trying to establish facts, and the coroner will have four statutory questions that he or she needs to answer by the end of the inquest. And those questions are who died, when they died, where they died, and it's how they came by their death. So in this particular scenario, I thought it would be quite useful to have and go through a case study that would allow us to sort of have a look at the anatomy of an inquest and how it would work in practical terms. So the case study that we are looking at today is, and this is a fictional name, of course, Chloe, who is 24 years old. She has a history of emotionally unstable personality disorder and previously has been known to self-harm. She's recently been discharged from a brief voluntary admission to an acute trust following an overdose. 2 weeks later, she was readmitted after a further overdose, medically stabilised on a general ward, and then was awaiting a mental health liaison assessment. However, there was a several-hour delay before the review took place, and during that window, Chloe left the ward unobserved and was found nearby a short time later, having taken her own life. So on this basis, in Chloe's case, it's the how. The question is what the family and the trust would want to inquire about and try to ascertain. So nobody yet knows the full circumstances that led to her death. And it will be through calling witnesses and hearing evidence, reading through evidence, that hopefully we can help answer some of the questions certainly that the family may have.
Thank you. And you're right. So that how question is key. And as I understand it, the how can be an even bigger question if it's termed an Article 2 inquest, isn't it? So perhaps you could explain what that means and why that expands that how question.
Yeah, so there is. So Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights protects the right to life. And in some inquests, it imposes enhanced procedural duty. That's a broader how inquiry into the full circumstances of someone's death, rather than just the immediate medical cause, where the state may have breached its operational duty to protect a known, real and immediate risk to life. Now, In Chloe's case, it's arguable, but it's not clear, where, as she was under NHS care with a documented history of self-harm risk. So the trust may have known, or perhaps ought to have known, that there's a real and immediate risk to her life at the time of, particularly in her second admission. Now, whether the delay in the liaison, psychiatric liaison review and the observation level in place amounted to a systemic failure to respond to that risk is likely to be argued as a preliminary issue. And then, of course, the outcome determines whether the enhanced Article 2 inquiry and a jury is required, or whether a standard inquiry is sufficient. And just to touch base as well, just very briefly on the jury, a jury is legally required where the death occurred in state detention and when the cause is unknown, or it's a violent or unnatural death, or where the coroner considers there's a real and immediate risk to other lives if similar circumstances reoccur. So in this case study, in Chloe's case, since she wasn't formally detained, a jury would only be invoked if Article 2 is found to be engaged and the coroner decides a public interest in scrutinising the trust system.
Thanks. And I suppose it's relevant then if there's that word, that state custody or state detention. So in certain circumstances, it's obvious if someone is under the control of the state, let's say they're a prisoner and they die in prison, that is someone who's clearly under the control of the state because they're not allowed to leave prison and they've died in the prison. Similarly, if someone's under a detention under the Mental Health Act, they are equally under the control of the state because the state, in this case, a hospital or a mental health hospital, is exercising its powers to detain them and hold them there. They're not allowed to leave. And of course, it's, so if they then die whilst under that control, that in itself would trigger the Article 2 right. Thank you. So, Dan, using the Chloe example, I suppose, but also let's think about other examples, what triggers an inquest? You know, why is it that some deaths in hospital trigger an inquest and others don't?
So the duty to investigate comes from a piece of legislation called the Coroners and Justice Act 2009. And a part of that, another section one, is that a coroner who is made aware of the of a body of a deceased person within that coroner's area must, as soon as practical, conduct an investigation into that person's death. If they had a violent or a natural death, the cause of death was unknown, or the deceased died whilst in custody or otherwise in state detention. So you and India have already talked about state detention, so I'm going to avoid that, going into that again. But really, in hospital or healthcare cases generally, so if someone were to pass away in an acute hospital, a lot of the time it will come under the unknown cause of death element. So whether that involves human intervention, whether that involves the acquiring of some form of illness or disease, or even just investigating whether that illness or disease actually ended up running its natural course. So it could be because it's unexpected, but really for hospital cases or healthcare cases, it is more about that cause of death is unknown element or the unnatural death. So again, for example, if someone were to pass away in surgery, so a younger person who had no comorbidities that passed away whilst under anaesthetic, for example, would be considered to have an unnatural death. And that needs to be investigated. And that's why coroners start to investigate for an inquest at that point.
Thank you. And then I suppose just following on from that, there's, I don't know if you want to expand on the medical examiner point. So the fact that there are certain people who are given the task in hospitals of assessing someone's death, doing a preliminary report and then reporting or otherwise to the coroner. Is that right?
That's right. So there are medical examiners, and medical examiners are, as you say, they are there at a trust or as part of a local authority that will look at deaths, and they will have a quick look at the medical records, and they'll have their own brief investigation to see whether they feel that the person died a violent or a natural death, or the cause of death is unknown. And then at that point, they can refer a death to a coroner. And then it's up to the coroner then to decide whether they agree with that medical examiner or whether they think, no, actually, this is more than likely to be a natural death, or this was an expected death, so I'm not going to actually run an investigation.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, so let's move on in the stories. We've heard the really tragic story of Chloe. And I think it's worth mentioning at this point that just because we deal with inquests all the time, it doesn't for a moment belittle them or make it any easier when we're having to deal with and manage some of these cases. And that certainly goes for the families, without doubt, but it also goes for the clinicians involved in these cases, particularly if they've known the person a while or even if they haven't. So I think it's important just to pause there for a moment, just to recognize that we are dealing with people. So the death has been reported to the coroner, and the coroner has decided or otherwise to hold an inquest. So Indy, can you perhaps talk us through the process? And I suppose it might help to explain when you're doing that, why it is that sometimes inquests can take months or even years to be held after a person dies.
Yes, of course. I mean, I think a lot of it is going to be, it's all information gathering, isn't it? Collating evidence. And that sometimes can be the issue, particularly for coroners as well, who are sort of running the show, so to speak. And it's a coroner that is managing this inquiry. Certainly, to touch upon your point about witnesses, it isn't easy. It's not easy for the family, but it's also not easy for the witnesses either. I mean, our role as lawyers is there to sort of take them through the evidence and to make it as easy as possible and explaining the process clearly so that they know what to expect on the day of when they're giving evidence and not to be blindsided. So we try as lawyers to manage expectations, review their statements, you know, cover things like do's and don'ts and court etiquette. And we work to give in clear, honest advice. We often have pre-inquest meetings with witnesses where we'll sort of do almost like a mock run of the types of questions that the coroner will be interested to ask so that the witnesses can have a think about what their response is going to be. But a lot of it is about reducing unnecessary anxiety. I mean, many witnesses come in fearing the worst. And I guess that stems from the fear of aggressive cross-examination. And as Dan said at the start, you know, it's not meant to be controversial, and it is a fact-finding exercise. But it can sometimes feel like that. And so witnesses can often feel like they've been called because they've done something wrong. And often that's not the case. Sometimes it can be because obviously the family may need a further explanation of a very technical medical process or treatment plan, in which case medics and clinicians are called. So yeah, it's about being honest and open, and that's what the family and the coroner are looking for, and we're there to sort of help them through that process.
So thanks, Indy. Yeah, and of course, you know, you're talking about evidence gathering, and you're absolutely right. The witness statement needs to be prepared really carefully, and the witnesses themselves need to be talked through the process. And I suppose as part of that evidence gathering, the coroner will need to establish who they want to hear from, what they want to read. And that could include medical records, serious incident investigation reports, as you say, witness statements, policies, protocols, all of these things which will guide the coroner into establishing what exactly happened and what the processes were and what they ought to have been.
That's absolutely right. And to help with all of that, what we have is often a pre-inquest hearing, which is almost like a case management hearing. So it's at that point that the coroner will address all those issues that you've just highlighted. Who do we need to hear from? The scope of the inquest, how far back do we need to go? What evidence is required for disclosure purposes? And also witnesses, who's going to be called and who's going to be read, as we call read under Rule 23. So all those preliminary matters are dealt with at a pre-inquest hearing, generally speaking. And those are, you can have more than one. Sometimes it depends on the inquest and how far down the line it is or how complex it is.
Thanks. And yeah, and you mentioned Rule 23 just there. Just so for the listeners, the coroner will either hear from a witness in person and the witness will be literally physically in the court, or sometimes they might be giving evidence online, and that will enable questions to be asked of them. But sometimes if the statement is that they've prepared is uncontroversial and there are no questions to arise from it, then the coroner will allow that evidence to be read, as you say, which is obviously a positive thing for witnesses, because it means that what they've said has been accepted, but also they don't need to attend the inquest itself. Dan, one of the things that I know comes up at a PIR, pre-inquest review hearing, is this term interested persons. Do you want to sort of elaborate on that a bit?
So interested persons, or IPs, is a group of people that have an interest in the deceased's death, effectively. And to go back to the non-adversarial element of the inquiry, if we can put it that way, is that there are no parties in an inquest. The chief coroner and the various chief coroners before have been at pains to say there are no parties. This is not liability exercise. It's not blame finding. It's very much an inquiry. So we do have interested persons. And interested persons can be effectively the next of kin. And that could extend to husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, nearest relatives, friends. If there aren't such a tight-knit family, personal representatives of the deceased. Also, when it comes to hospitals and GPs and corporate bodies such as that, then it will be the hospitals. Generally, unless a clinician was acting in their private capacity, generally with hospitals, it is always the hospital that is named as an interested person rather than the individual clinician. But of course, if there is a surgery that is undertaken under private capacity, then potentially that clinician can be brought in as their own IP. It can include care providers, social workers, social teams, and people such as that. What happens with IPs, or what is the benefit of being IPs, I suppose, is the next question that we should cover off. And that is that it gives those persons particular rights. So it gives those persons the right to be told about hearings, be informed of adjournments, be provided with statements and disclosure, examine witnesses, make submissions, and be told of the time and date of the post-mortem as well. So it actually gives an ability to be engaged in the process. What I'm often told at inquests is that an IP status is there for people to use it if they wish and to exercise it. And we would always encourage, if you are involved in inquest, engage with it fully so that you can put forward questions, queries, and engage with the process to see how the deceased actually died.
Okay, so let's, again, we'll talk along this journey then. So we've had a PIR, Greencrest Review, and the coroner has named the family as an IP, an interested person, and they've also named the trust and perhaps the GP. So I suppose the next immediate step, if we haven't done this already, is to advise our client, so let's say it's the trust in this case, to preserve all the evidence, make sure that the records are available and ready, make sure there's any protocols, procedures in place at the time the person died that are preserved. But preparing the witnesses is a bit more, was very much more technical and very important. So Indy, how would you go about preparing a witness? What would you explain to them? What would they ask you? And what documentation would you help them with?
So I always ask before any meeting with any witnesses whether or not they've attended an inquest before. And sometimes they have, sometimes they haven't. And for those that haven't, we generally will go through the process and generally talk through the format and layout of what an inquest looks like, how what the coroner will start off with. And the focus obviously will be their statement. So as I said earlier, any questions that the coroner is likely to ask, we will generally try and go through those in a pre-inquest meeting. In terms of documentary evidence, I mean, obviously their notes. So, I mean, we always say to have access to any notes that they may wish to rely on or want to refer to, or that they have referred to when writing their statements. And those are all really, really important. So any records that would have been disclosed to the coroner at the start, presumably in this case, the coroner would have asked for the Community Mental Health Trust records as well as the acute trust records. So it's reference to those and just taking through the witness for those pertinent parts of the records. Because of course, as you know, the records can be quite hefty. There could be hundreds of pages and difficult to navigate. So it's always worth just flagging those beforehand.
Thanks. And let's just say that one of the witnesses that you're speaking to, perhaps it's someone who looked after Chloe, is extremely anxious. Not only are they worried about giving evidence and they're worried about seeing the Clary's parents again, what they might say to her, they're also worried about any repercussions there might be with regulatory bodies, say the GMC. I mean, how would you alleviate those concerns?
We always try to alleviate any anxiety by explaining that, as I said, it's a fact-finding exercise. I appreciate those concerns will be there, but the coroner is aware. 9 times out of 10, when I have written to the coroner to explain that a particular witness is very anxious, the coroner has always been quite sympathetic to that fact. And, you know, if adjustments need to be made, so for example, giving evidence virtually, then that, and it can be accommodated, then the coroners are usually amenable to that as well. So, you know, we do try where we can. And I always think as well, for those witnesses, if it's possible, rather than being the very first witness to give evidence, it's always useful to see their peers, perhaps, who are a bit more experienced, to see how they give evidence so that it puts them at ease. But essentially, really, yeah, it's a fact-finding exercise. And as we said at the start, it's trying to establish how Chloe came by her death. And so that's what we're helping the coroner with.
Yeah, I agree. And a lot of it is, like all evidence giving, is about context and honesty and openness, isn't it? Because, you know, any person giving evidence, all they're really being asked to explain is what happened. Yeah, because otherwise, without their evidence, their oral evidence, all you have is what's written down in the notes. And with the best will in the world, the notes don't tell the whole story. They might say something about Chloe. They might say Chloe was feeling happy today, Chloe was feeling sad today. They probably won't delve into much about everything that was transpiring between Chloe and, I don't know, her family, her friends, the interactions with the clinicians. Sometimes they were, and to be fair, a lot of mental health notes are particularly detailed and probably more detailed than many, but either way, you do need that witness to really paint a picture, to give that context, don't you, so that they can help the coroner understand what was going on the day and ultimately understand whether there was a real and immediate risk of death. Was Chloe genuinely contemplating taking her own life? If so, should something have been done, or could something have been done to prevent that? So, it's for them to be open and honest. And also, I think what's really important, I'm sure you agree, is for a medical witness, i.e. a nurse, doctor, whoever it is, to only give evidence on the facts. I think sometimes they feel they're doing the coroner a favour or a service by giving opinion evidence, which they probably can do because they probably are experts in their fields. But I think it's important that they know that for the purpose of giving evidence at an inquest, they are factual witnesses.
If I can come in there as well, just because I think it comes on to that point, is also we can't coach witnesses what to say. We can only guide them as to what types of questions may come to them. And what I often see, and I've sat in with you, Indy, as well, in various pre-inquest meetings, but actually that helps the grey matter get going. And once we've been through the pre-inquest meeting, actually people do feel an awful lot more engaged with the process.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is far less adversarial than people expect it to be. I mean, the coroner is there to control the proceedings and the atmosphere is generally respectful. And, you know, families, if particularly those that are represented, you know, the questions that are asked are often thoughtful and considered questions. And the length varies considerably too. I mean, like in this case study, in Chloe's case study, with expert evidence and possibly a jury, it could run several days. And so, you know, we want to alleviate any anxiety because it could be a lengthy process. You want to go in the best position possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's delve in a bit more detail on this Chloe case and in the context of the inquest itself. So you've had your PIR in which the coroner has decided who the interested persons are. They've decided what evidence they need to gather in their bundle, i.e. what witness statements, what medical records, policies, procedures, that sort of thing, any investigation reports. They've also decided, you mentioned that word scope, Indy, so the scope of the inquest, and that means whether it is an Article 2 inquest or not, which, as you said earlier, goes to the question of that how is it just, in inverted commas, how Chloe died, or is it how and in what circumstances, which can mean going back several months or even years into her, all of her mental health history and her medical treatment. There is, I think, another aspect which goes into the conclusions of an inquest. We're probably going about this the wrong way, but Dan, do you want to just touch on conclusions and what difference an Article 2 inquest would make to a conclusion?
There are various conclusions that a coroner can come to, and a coroner has to come by these conclusions on effectively safety and what's called the Galbraith Plus test. So there's short form, which could be natural causes, which is the coming to the end of a naturally occurring illness or disease. You could have accident misadventure. You could have suicide. You can also have what's called a narrative, which is a brief neutral statement as to how the deceased died. There is also, onto a narrative, you can have what's called a neglect rider. And a neglect rider is, well, I think, from the Chief Coroner's Bench book, has now increased its hurdle to get over now, really. And that's a whole nother talk, I think, on neglect riders.
Thanks, Dan. And then you mentioned the systems as well, because obviously the conclusion, if it's an Article 2, can include criticisms of the systems and things, can't it? So, okay, having talked about conclusions, I want to just now go back to the day of the inquest itself. So perhaps, Indy, if you could talk us through. So you've got your witness, you've prepared them, you've had your meeting, or witnesses potentially, you've had your meetings with them, and you've arranged to come to court to meet them half an hour earlier. Perhaps you've met in a coffee shop to just alleviate any anxiety. So tell us about the day itself. Let's assume it's a one-day inquest for now.
So generally, I mean, court can start anything between sort of 9:30 or 10 o'clock. If there is a coffee shop nearby, then usually advise that we meet in a coffee shop and just chat through any sort of last minute queries that witnesses may have, and also to alleviate any anxiety. And then what would usually happen is that the coroner will open the inquest and just set out a summary of sort of why we're there. Sometimes coroners can go in a bit more depth and set out exactly what we're there for. So the four statutory questions that we talked about, and just sort of explain the format of what's going to be, how the inquest is going to be heard. And that will also include a running order of the witnesses and in what order they will be heard. Usually, we often hear from the pathologist first, but that's not set in stone. It could be any witness, really. It may be some cases where there's difficulty in pinning down a witness to give evidence at a certain particular time and date and needs to be brought forward, then the coroner will usually accommodate that. But generally, it's a pathologist and then possibly a toxicologist that is heard from first, and then straight into the other witnesses such as GP and witnesses from the trusts. There is a lunch break usually, and often family needs other breaks as well. Those will be accommodated. And generally court can finish anything between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock on the actual day. But it will be the coroner, as I said earlier, who will be leading and asking the main questions. They will start off and ask the witness questions flowing from their statement. And then if the family is represented, it will be over to the family's barrister or solicitor. Or if they are unrepresented, then obviously, of course, the family themselves can ask questions of the witness. And as long as those questions are something that the witness can answer within their remit, because sometimes it may be a question that falls outside of their remit and has to be perhaps addressed to a different witness, they will obviously answer those questions. And then finally, if there is any questions that I feel as a lawyer representing the trust in this particular case, then obviously I can ask questions if I feel that there needs to be certain evidence that perhaps I'm aware of that needs to be brought to the attention of the coroner and the family that hasn't been brought out already, then it may be that I ask some questions at the end.
Thanks, Lindy. And the other, we've talked a lot about factual witnesses, so the doctors, the nurses, the family as well giving evidence. And I also said earlier that the clinicians should stick to their remit. So they should be talking about the facts, even though they might well be experts in their fields. But there are times, aren't there, where the coroner will want to hear from an expert, an independent person. So in a case like this, they might want to hear from a psychiatrist, say. Do you have any experience of that? Do you think that's a positive thing for inquests?
Often, yes, I think it can be quite positive. I mean, obviously, it means it's independent scrutiny on the case. So it's somebody that's looking at the facts and the documentation as recorded and then giving their view from their expertise. So generally speaking, yes, it can be quite beneficial. There are occasions where I have had cases in the past where perhaps the clinicians that I am representing disagree with the expert opinion, and that then can become a little bit problematic. But of course, the expert's opinion is his or her opinion. I think overall it can be quite helpful to have that, and they are used in more of the complex cases, certainly.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, the other people who could ask questions, although this is only if it is a jury, is the jury themselves. And I found, I don't know about your experience, both of you, but I found that juries, they tend to ask extremely sensible questions that really get to the heart of things.
I totally agree, Rob.
Yeah. Thanks, Cindy. So we've talked about the evidence and the day itself. There will be then an opportunity for the representatives of the interested persons to make what's called submissions. And those submissions are invited by the coroner, and they are around the law. And there'll be submissions about the conclusion, you know, what you believe to be the right conclusion that the coroner should return, or if there is a jury, what the coroner should offer to the jury to return. But the other thing that I wanted to touch on, and this is particularly true in medical treatment cases, is this thing called Regulation 28, or Prevention of Future Deaths. And you often get asked to make submissions on that as well. Dan, do you want to just touch on PFDs, what they mean, what they are, what those submissions would be, and why it's so important for a coroner to hear about it?
Of course. Thanks, Rob. So Prevention of Future Deaths report, or Regulation 28 report, it comes from Regulation 28 of the Coroner's Investigations Regulations 2013. And what that does is it puts a duty on the coroner to ensure that acts or omissions or issues like this will not effectively happen again and will not cause a death in a similar circumstance to the death that's happened. Obviously, it's really there for patient safety, which is a very, very good thing. It's also there to try and pick up trends so that if there is an issue with medical records, or if there is an issue between divisions or departments. So that can actually be sorted out through a statutory instrument, effectively. But what will happen, and I think Indy touched on that, is that you'll have what's called a prevention of future deaths witness, who is generally a patient safety divisional head in the trust or somebody like that, or you could have a medical director come along who will talk to the investigation that the trust or the healthcare body is undertaking. So what will happen, and you talked about this already, Rob, is that there is a lot of documentation, and part of that documentation that will be disclosed will be a review. Whether that takes the form of an after action review, an SJR, which is a structured judgment review, an SU, you know, serious untoward incident report, a root cause analysis, a PSIRF report, you know, or PSII. So it can take many forms. But what the coroner is really looking for is that actually the corporate body or the trust or the IP has undertaken a proper investigation as to what has happened, and to actually look at, have there been any acts or omissions or even failings that have caused or more than minimally contributed to this death. And then what the coroner really wants to see is a really, really good action plan at the end. It's to show that the trust or the healthcare body's gone away. They've thought about it and they've undertaken an investigation and thought, okay, well, on this occasion, this element did not work. Or on this occasion, this element worked well. So what they actually really want to do is look at if something didn't work particularly well, what changes have been put in place? Does there need to be training undertaken? And if so, in that action plan, set out what that training is, when was it undertaken, and what is the uptake of that training? What they'd like to see, and I've had it in the past with midwives and obstetricians, for example, is they want to see a statistic. You know, we want to see that 80% of our obstetricians have undertaken X, Y, and Z training, or in 80% of our delivery suites that we've actually got X bit of equipment now. And that's what it's there for. And I want that witness to have done their homework, revised, very clued up on what the safety aspects are, and that they can reassure the coroner that a death like this won't happen again or in similar circumstances. Or even if there is a national issue, so for example, if there is a lack of a particular antibiotic, the coroner doesn't have to just do a Regulation 28 report to the IPs. They can do it to anybody, and it's any patient safety issue that comes up. And it doesn't have to be particularly at the end of an inquest either. It can be at any point in that coroner's investigation. So it could be after a pre-inquest review hearing, it could be halfway through the hearing, it can be at the end. So it covers off a lot. And what happens with those Regulation 28 reports is they get put on the Chief Coroner's website now, and the healthcare body will have 56 days to respond. And then the replies are now put on the Chief Coroner's website as well. So why is it important? Well, it's very much a patient safety aspect, and it helps increase patient safety throughout any form of NHS or any form of corporate body. So it doesn't have to be just healthcare. But also, it is not necessarily a bad thing, in that if it is a national issue, for example, it can bring those national bodies into the attention of what is happening at a granular level. And so I hope that covers that off.
It does. It's a fantastic summary. Thanks, Dan. Finally, I think the one thing we haven't touched on, and there's not much to say other than these inquests can be high profile and they may attract media attention. They don't always, and sometimes they're more likely to, if there is a jury, for example, or if there's for some other reason it's caught the headlines. But I think the important thing is to remember that you need to prepare for that. You need to prepare a press statement in advance. It needs to be quite neutral. Obviously, if we were representing, we would help you on that. But I would certainly be advising any witnesses not to speak to the press during the inquest or after the inquest, and just to focus on giving evidence themselves. So thank you, Dan and Indy. I'm going to ask you both to give a little takeaway. So for listeners, what would you... Perhaps, Indy, you can start. What would you like listeners to take away from today's podcast?
I think to remember that the inquest process is designed to establish facts. Good preparation and clear communication is key in these types of cases. So certainly would urge witnesses to prepare well in advance if they can, so that they're ready to give evidence on the day.
For me, all I can really suggest is that if you do have any worries, any concerns, any queries, raise them at an early stage, because for you, it will worry you to the nth degree. However, it's probably just a very, very simple answer. And just that quick email back, that quick telephone call, I'll just encourage you to get involved. And if you've got any queries about demystifying inquests, they're public hearings. Ask your legal team if you can go along to an inquest as well elsewhere and sit at the back and hopefully it will demystify it quite quickly.
Completely agree. Thanks, Dan. These inquests are effectively conversations. They are inquisitorial in that it's one person asking another person what happened, why it happened, how it happened, and sometimes in what circumstances it happened. It's really important, as you both said, to just prepare for it in advance and don't panic. I'm really conscious that we've spent today's podcast going through only one case study and in not much detail for obvious reasons. There are many, many, many different types of inquests, and there are obviously very different circumstances that we'd have to deal with and you'd have to deal with. By all means, come back to us and we'd be very happy to discuss any of these matters in more detail on a one-to-one basis. Really hope you enjoyed listening today. Please do subscribe, like, repost all of these other parts of affirmation for us to this podcast. We really value your feedback, not only so that we can improve, but also so that we can know what you want to hear about next. So please do get in touch, and we really look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you.